You're listening to 515, the Ultra Podcast, the show that invites you into the lives of people who make up the Ultra family. Here's your host for these conversations, Larry Ryan.
Thanks, MJ. In today's episode, I have an Ohana guest from my own neighborhood and whom I've known for many years through Steve Brown's Ultra events in Penticton. He has some unique stories to tell from his life outside of Ultra that I'm sure you'll want to hear. Hello, listener. I want to remind you to check out my new Ultra Tri-Fest coming to Whistler, British Columbia in August 2024. It has five racing formats to choose from, and the feature event will be the new Ultra 515 Worldwide Championships, in which racers from every 515 race in the world may attend. Get all the details at ultratrifestcanada.com and feel free to contact me personally with any questions. Today's Ohana guest has raced at Ironman Canada 25 times and competed in 8 515 races as an athlete. When not racing himself, he is often giving back and crewing for others. In his day job, he works as a paramedic, and he has taken those skills to volunteer in Ukraine during the war. A huge Vancouver Canucks fan, this gentleman is just down the road from me in Surrey, British Columbia. Most of you are going to know him. It's Will Rogers. Hi, Will.
Hey, Larry. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, thank you for coming and doing this interview after a long shift of paramedicking.
Yeah, it was an interesting day, as always, in the Lower Mainland. It's just one of those days where things roll into one thing, rolls into another. Typical, the opiate situation is still around, and it's going like gangbusters, unfortunately. So that's a big part of our stuff, is street level stuff, as well as the regular medical calls and regular, falls in the street and people that have issues at home that they need help.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm sure we can get into your job a little bit more, but the first thing I want to talk to you about, because you're a big Canucks fan, and maybe this is a little bit too local for most of the audience, but for the first time in a long time, as of the recording of this, the Canucks are in first place in the NHL, and that hasn't happened since 2011 and 2012. So I'm just wondering, as a Canucks fan, what do you think? How's the season going?
Well, I'm pretty pretty impressed. I had the opportunity to work as a standby paramedic last year at a couple of games, and of course watched them fairly closely whenever I had the chance. I was I wasn't exactly shocked that they're doing well this year. You could see the beginnings of that last year. They did put a couple of strings together of some good games. They were playing well. A lot of games that they were losing, they were still entertaining, and they were very close.
Mm-hmm. And how about you as a boy growing up? I know you played most sports. Did you play any hockey?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I played hockey for my teams here in Cloverdale, plus for my high school as well. And my original injury, of course, in rugby, that where I dislocated my knee and had to have surgery, took me out of all contact sports. I was a rugby player. Also, all sports that were like jumping and twisting, like, you know, volleyball and basketball, that's all out because of the nature of jumping and twisting and coming back, landing on different angles was just too much for my knee. So mm-hmm. I, fine-tuned things and stuck with what I was able to do with after gaining quite a bit of weight after leaving high school, is getting back into running and then falling into swimming, literally. And then, borrowing a friend's bike to get in, to do a triathlon. Yeah. And then the rest is history.
Well, I guess the triathlon works well for you because it's all just that straight linear motion.
Yeah, it is. There's no cutting and turning. I've done some races where we've ended up on trails, and I'm cautiously making my way through these trails because I know that one slip or rock or root or trip in the wrong direction can put me right back in the hospital with a blown knee again. And I don't, those kind of things I kind of shied away from, but inevitably there are races that end up on trails, and and sometimes the weather is not your friend. It can be very wet and slippery, and that all those things are playing on my mind when I'm doing that.
Yeah, yeah. So you got into triathlon then to try and get yourself back in the shape, you were saying, after letting it go for a couple of years. But it's never left you. You've had quite the run at Ironman Canada, I think dating back as early as 1990. Is that correct?
1987 was my first one.
87. Okay.
So 87 and 88. And I got into, Ironman Hawaii, the world championships, through the last year of the actual open lottery. And that was of course an incredible experience. That was the year of the Iron War with Dave Scott and Mark Allen.
And which I'm sure you saw personally because you were already at the finish line waiting for them to finish, right?
Well, no, not exactly. But if you look at that very famous picture of them, if you look very closely, you can see my pinky finger right behind them, chasing them down. Actually, I was only 100 meters or so from that picture as I was heading out and they were coming in.
Oh yeah.
And so I remember saying to the photographer, you know, they're coming right behind, you know, they're right there. And he turns to me and he quickly looked up and he says, "Yes. Yes, I know that. I'm a photographer."
Yeah, that's my job.
Yeah. So yeah, that picture, that very famous picture, I was very close to that when that happened. I was the 1,000th finisher across the finish line in that race. And it was an unbelievable experience and something that I cherish with me to this day and think about that race all the time.
So well, that must be the thing that got you hooked into doing it then.
It was just one thing led, you know, one event led to another. And, when I first started doing triathlon in 1986, the year of Expo, I started off very much on my own with getting some advice from people I saw at some 10Ks that I was doing and, just picking up bits of advice here and there. And then I was, just leaving my hotel at the Delta Lakeside, my hotel room, because none of my friends lived there at the time or family. And out of the other room across from me came a friend of mine that I'd worked with at the Cloverdale racetrack. No. And he looks at me and I looked at him and we were both racing in the race and we were racing and training friends for the next 30 years, basically, you know, Kevin Sweetman. And so he did a whole bunch of Ironmans with me and it was just something that we did. We trained together and, you know, along the way picked up, you know, other friends that were training, made lifelong friends that way. Mm-hmm. It's been one of those experiences that it's another avenue to go out into an effort with other people and suffer along with them, you know, these things. And we just went every year. It was something that we planned for every year. Like the next day we'd sign up for the next year, we'd all be there.
Right.
You know,
And then obviously spending all those years in Penticton, at one point you start to hear about this other race called the Ultraman Canada, and you decided to go crew at that race. Tell me a little bit about your first experience at Ultraman.
Well, it was actually, I knew about it fairly early on, and I would see the markings on the road when I was driving up there, some of the mileage and stop, you know, and aid, you know, mileage markers and, you know, turn here, turn there for Ultraman. Right. And I vividly remember seeing those markings and going like, I'll never ever be able to do that. That's one that's out of reach for me. And I actually, on the way back from one of my trips up to the Kootenays, I stopped and the racers were going by and with their crew teams, you know, with their chase cars and stuff like that. And I'm still I was going like, this is amazing. How do these people do this? And I got into, you know, I got into to crewing because I just wanted an introduction into the race. Mm-hmm. And I asked Steve Brown about crewing and you know, I could volunteer and can I help somebody out? And he said, sure. So he hooked me up with Al Mack and Mike, his friend from England or from Scotland. They were both in the armed forces together. And Mike now lives in Kelowna with his wife. And so we jumped in. And neither of us had crewed at a race before. I think Al had tried had competed in the one in Wales, Ultraman Wales, and it was great. You know, it was a lot of fun. It was a challenge. It was a bit of a trial by fire because a lot of things went wrong. A lot of things went right because ultimately he finished the race.
Oh, that's great. And when you were doing that race, obviously you start thinking, well, maybe I can do it, but you needed a little bit of a persuasion to do it because you were still, there was one of the events that you were a little bit hesitant of. What was that?
Well, I knew looking at the people doing it and how they were getting through it and the some of their planning things, some of them were horrendously way off the mark. In other words, were like, you know, really, really well done, planning and everything else. And so at the awards, one of the gentlemen came up to me, and Steve Brown had come up to me before and said, you know, about my thing where I'd done an individual triathlon for charity. And, you know, the swim was across the Georgia Strait and the bike was from Victoria.
Oh, hold on. Wait a second. Hold on. You can't just throw out the swims across the Georgia Strait. We got an international audience here. And this is just a made up thing that you were doing, to be clear. Yeah. So tell us, how far is it to swim across the Georgia Strait? And where did you swim from and to help the listener a little bit?
Okay. It's from basically halfway up the causeway at the Tawasin Ferry Terminal. Just south of Vancouver, the actual city of Vancouver, in Delta. And then you swim across the Georgia Strait, now called the Salish Sea, over to, I swam to an island called Galliano Island. And, the BC Ferries Corporation has all the distances, marked out. And so it's 21 kilometers, in the open ocean. Mm-hmm. And I've done that four times now. And then I would finish my swim, and then a day or two later, I wasn't right away. I would set out on my bike from mile zero of TransCanada and ride up Highway 3 through Princeton to right into Penticton, and then I would turn around a couple of days later.
How many kilometers are we talking about there when you're riding?
That is. That was, I believe, if I remember correctly, that's about 450 kilometers. So riding over 2 days, and we would overnight, and then I would turn around once in Penticton and then run back to Victoria. So roughly, it turns out to be just under 1,000 kilometers, I think, the whole way, if you add up the run and the bike and the swim. And there were times, a couple of the times I actually went around and followed the Ironman route where I went through Osoyoos. And a couple of other times, because of time management and things like that, and the date, how the dates fell, I made it short. I only did like 950 kilometers. And I would run directly from Penticton down the Highway 3 through Carameas and then up to, and then down to Victoria. The first year I did that, I ended up pulling my IT band incredibly badly and finished. I was on my way up to Penticton, and because the first year I did this was only a run, and I ended up on crutches, the forearm crutches, not the ones that go under your arm. I was on those for 110 kilometers.
Oh, wow.
And I was a little slower, but I was pain free. So it was quite a relief to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. I thought it was just a unique thing to be able to pull off. I'd been in so much pain for so long, you know, trying to get to Princeton, and I'd brought these things because I'd been having Achilles heels problems. Okay. And I thought, well, you know, I'll just throw these crutches in just in case something else happens and I can't continue and I hurt myself, like it's difficult to walk. Mm-hmm. And I motored around the parking lot at where I stayed in Princeton, and I thought, well, let's go. I guess we're on. And away we go.
So an event like that, obviously you have some support in the waters when you're going to go 22 kilometers. What about the rest of the route? Did you have a crew per se, or someone with you along the way?
It was anybody that was willing to volunteer that day to drive. I had a support ambulance that was donated to me by the ambulance service, which was incredibly helpful. I can't thank them enough for that. And some days it was hard scraping up people that would have the time to commit to a day like that, or maybe a couple of days.
Right.
Other people came out for a few days, like 3 or 4 days, but everybody has commitments and stuff like that. So that was a big part of it, was getting people to be able to drive my support vehicle. And I, you know, would carry extra runners and first aid stuff for my feet, extra clothes, food, and all that stuff. Right.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a happening. It was only me doing it. which was fine. So, you know, I knew pretty much how to take care of myself, but I needed that vehicle around with, and knowing what was in it.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's just the way it worked out, and it worked out fine. You know, I ended up with, for the first time in my life, even after doing Ironman and stuff like that, I ended up with blisters on my blisters, which I didn't think was possible, but let me tell you, it's possible. It's a real thing.
And despite doing this, like, quite large event over multiple days, you still didn't feel like you were maybe prepared enough to do an Ultraman event until someone else kind of talked you into it.
Yeah. The thing was, is I knew I could do the swim. I knew for sure. Cause my best part is the swimming, and I'm very comfortable swimming, even in open ocean water and in rough water. Mm-hmm. And so the biking, I knew with the enough training and the right equipment and stuff like that, I should be able to. I knew what I had to average, and I was able to average that on training days. But the run, you know, when you think about it, running 84, you know, double marathon is just such a grandiose thing to even try and get your head around. You can't, or it's very difficult to.
Right.
But
the time limit of 12 hours that you have to do it in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because clearly you could run the distance.
Well, it depends on how you classify running, right? You know, like there's the Ironman shuffle, because, you know, we all know what that is, but where you just sort of shuffle along and you just keep moving forward. And you have a cutoff time of 17 hours. And of course, it's all relative to when you get off your bike and how much time you spend in transition. But the 84.4 kilometers was just, it just seemed like it was so far for me that I'd never even come close to running that far. Like, not even like a marathon for me is tough, because I'm not really a runner. I remember originally Steve Brown had held up my poster and had the mileage of the swim, bike, and the run and you know, mapped out on the bottom of the poster, and he literally walked up to me and held it up in front of my face. He says, if you can do this, you can do my race. And I went, oh man, Steve, I cannot run 84 kilometers. I just cannot do it. I cannot get my head around it. And I know physically I cannot do it. And so he sort of, you know, mumbled and walked off and, you know, and everything else. And then Darwin Holt, I was talking with him, and he says, you know, I know you do these Ironmans, and I've seen your poster and stuff like that. I said, why aren't you doing this? And I said, well, I don't believe I can run. He said, no, you know better than that. He said, you know, if you can run 20 miles in 4 hours, that leaves 32 miles to do in 8 hours. And that is a 15-minute mile walk for 8 hours. And that's bang on 12 hours. And I went, really? You know, like, and I took my phone out and started doing the calculations. And I go, like, oh, shit, he's right. And at that moment, I seriously thought about doing it. And then I got a hold of Steve Brown, and when I was crewing in Florida, because I was on the crewing bang, the Ultraman crewing bang wagon.
Yeah.
And I went up to Steve and I said, okay, I'll do your stupid race. and he goes, well, registration's closed. I said, you'll open it up for me, won't you, Steve? And he goes, yeah, okay, I'll open it up for you one day only. And it's closed as soon as you enter it. And I said, okay, so give me a date. And he sent me the date later, and I registered and got into it. And it was one of those things that, it's like when we're all, like any Ironman athlete is, especially Ironman, is you see these people at the very beginning, they're so nervous. They're scared to death at what they're about to, you know, achieve.
Yeah.
And I literally, honestly, I put in the time, the training, and I had this mental map of how I was going to pull this off. And I could not wait to get going. I literally could not wait for that gun to go off and start and get my, you know, get my Ultraman belt under me. and I remember, you know, standing at the start line of that first race and going, like, this is going to be one hell of an adventure. And it was, you know, and I just maintained my pace. You know, I bang on 4 hours at 20 miles, and then made sure I was a few seconds under 15 minute miles every mile.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, really has served me well over the course of my Ultramans.
Yeah.
And in like my last race in Florida at the 20 mile marker, I was 10 minutes behind because because I didn't have a very good 20 miles. In fact, one of the other racers said to me when we started, said, "How do you feel?" I said, "I feel like garbage." And he goes, "Yeah, me too." I said, "You're right. Have a nice day, you know." But I was able to do the, you know, quickly calculate in my head the math of how many seconds. Okay, now I've got to do 14:45 minutes.
Right.
And I made up that 10 minutes that I'd lost over the course of the next 32 miles, a little bit at a time. And I finished with like 10, I think 9 or 10 minutes to spare. And that's, you know, typically what I do.
Right.
The fastest.
And that's,
the fastest
and that's not been. Scary at all for your crew all day long.
No, because I've told them what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. And they would look at their watches and say, "Oh, you're bang on. Okay. You're good. You know, you're 15 minutes and 10 seconds. So because of the hills, now the next one, you're going to do 14 and a half minutes."
Right.
And of course in Ultraman Canada, as you know, the last 8 miles, last 13 kilometers, a lot of it is downhill. So if you are behind, you can make up a lot of time. Like Lucy.
I have a triathlon pro and Ultraman champion coming up in a couple of episodes. I sat down to speak with Kate Bevilacqua recently, and I thought I'd give you a preview of that episode. Here she is speaking of her first Ironman victory at her home race in Western Australia.
So I had accumulated enough points, went to Kona in 2010. Again, Kona has just been my nemesis. Not a great race. But felt like I had some fitness, so threw myself on the start line of Ironman Western Australia because it was just down the road. Mm-hmm. And, found myself leading the race, which was just unbelievable. I don't necessarily have any regrets, but I was just so excited to be leading the last, like, 10 Ks or so. I was, you know, waving to the crowd, you know, couldn't get the smile off my face, although I had Rebecca Keat running me down. And I was just not drinking. I was not eating. I was not focusing on where I was and what I should be doing. So the last couple of Ks, I was quite delusional, and coming down the finishing chute, was crawling, like grabbing railings, and literally did my finish line photo of my first Ironman victory is me crawling over the line and laying on the ground. So it's not the whole big yay, hands up, celebrate, you won an Ironman and it's your home race. there was none of that. I just was laying on the ground thinking, okay, it's done. I'm not moving ever again. Like, I can retire now. But it's a fantastic one to have ticked off and won.
That will be coming up in episode 10 this season. Now back to my conversation with Will as we discuss some of his 5:15 events. So you have done a number of the 5:15 distance races now. You've done Ultraman Canada. You've done Steve Brown's 5:20. You've mentioned Florida. I know you've also done the World Championship. You've done Australia. You've done Mexico. You've even done Israel.
Yeah.
Maybe just pick out one or two of those and give a story to share with the listener about, you know, one of your more memorable experiences at one of these races.
Well, Mexico was interesting because, you know, I think it's 6,000 feet. It's up in the central part of Zacatecas, the central part of the country. So in the morning before the sun comes up, it's quite cold. Like I was freezing to death on the bike the first 25 miles. And then the sun comes up and it gets quite warm. It'll get up to like mid 70s into the 80s Fahrenheit. And it's beautiful cycling weather that time. And I'd been warned about that there was a 5 kilometer stretch that was gravel, you know, and so it was muddy and graveling, and I'm going very, very slowly, picking my way through on this gravel road, and I'm going like, oh man, I can't, like, I, you know, like $4,000 wheels rims on this road. And then you get through it, and then, you know, you settle down and things are good again, and you're making a reasonable time. And then there's a second part, which is about 400 meters long. And the trouble with that gravel part is that it's at the very bottom of a very long, very steep hill. So you're trucking along about 40 miles an hour, you know, about 60 K an hour, and you have to hammer on your brakes and slow down and pick your way through this gravel road and then climb the other side. And then go up to a lookout and then turn around and come flying down the other side at about 40 miles an hour again, and then hammer on your brakes. This is something the cyclists hate doing.
Yeah.
The swim in Mexico was I loved it, but only because I'm Canadian and I'm used to swimming in cold water. It was about 15 degrees.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, people were, you know, bootied up and gloved up and had, you know, neoprene head hats on, swimming hats on. Yeah.
Well, it is mostly Mexican people that do the Mexico race, so maybe they're not used to that cold water.
Well, I mean, most people were from Central America, yes. Mm-hmm. And it was a crystal clear cooling pond for a mine. But the water was crystal clear. It was quite nice. It was, you know, once I got moving in the water, of course, the water inside your wetsuit warms up. And you did 13 laps around this island and swam under a brick bridge. And it was kind of like swimming a NASCAR race where I was catching and lapping people. And it was fun.
More incentive.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because I enjoy the swimming and I enjoy that kind of challenge. And I was, you know, out of like 30 racers, I was second out of the water that day. And then ended up being fifth overall the first day, which is, you know, I thought it was, I was quite happy with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and then at the finish line, the final finish line on day three, they go right into the awards there. Is that right?
Yeah, they do. I was the second to last finisher on the double marathon that day. And basically,
because you came in at 11:50 something, as you do.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember I had a policeman on his motorcycle, you know, right beside me, coming through the last part of the city, telling me, you know, you got to, you know, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. He was worried I wasn't going to make it, and you know, with him with his machine gun strapped across his back, yeah. And so it was quite the experience, yeah. And of course, you know, once the race was over. You know, it's in the evening and of course the sun goes down and it gets really cold again. And so we're at this awards dinner and everybody's like layered up with boots and long pants and like, you know, two jackets and a sweater and a long sleeve shirt, you know, and which I wasn't prepared for. So I was quite cold. I had some clothes, but, and not quite as much as I should have.
Oh, yeah.
So, it was an interesting, very interesting endeavor in Mexico. I was interviewed by Mexican TV, and when Van and my translator had told the radio, the person, the TV person that was interviewing me about the distances involved, mm-hmm. and my age at the time was 58, and he says, "Where are you from? Another planet?" And I said, "No, I'm just Canadian." So, but it was a great experience, and you know, Zacatecas is not a place that people will normally think of going. And a lot of Mexicans ask me, you know, like, why did you go to Zacatecas? Like, yeah. There's nothing there, but there is. I mean, there's obviously cities and infrastructure and stuff like that, but mm-hmm. it's not a tourist town, not by any means.
Yeah.
The pool I was training in beforehand before the race down there. You know, it probably would have been condemned 10 years ago here in Canada.
Right.
But that's what they have. And so that's what they use.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the things that, you know, that triathlon and Ironman and Ultraman have brought to my life is these experiences.
Right.
You know, I've tried and meeting these incredibly wonderful people. Mm-hmm. Generous people, generous to a fault. You know, they just can't do enough for, literally cannot do enough for you when you're there. I was treated like royalty when I was there.
Yeah. Well, I know Van Sanchez is quite the host.
Yeah. Yeah. it was great. It was great seeing, you know, staying at his place, meeting his mother. I enjoyed every minute of my trip down to Mexico.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. And these people that you meet, as you say, and you, I think, are probably known around the ultra community as one who definitely gives back. So you've gone out and crewed quite a few times for people at various events as well. You may have crewed more than you've raced. Tell me about some of the crewing experiences that you've had and some of the people that you've worked with, please.
Crewing in itself is an experience. You don't have to pick one or the other over one race over the other. Every race has its, it's ups and downs, it's idiosyncrasies, and of course it depends on your athlete.
Yeah.
Right. Some of my athletes have been terrible, you know just barely got through the swim and you know done well on the bike and the run or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
I've had them throw temper tantrums. I've had you know people crying their eyes out other others that are like, oh, you know, like ho-hum, this is just another day. you know, and do an eight hour double marathon, you know, like no problem, yeah. You know, and at the end, you know, there's been a couple of times when we finished the race and my crew partner, we're looking at each other going like, what, we're done? Because we're so used to these 12 hour days and someone just bangs off a double marathon and then, you know, wants, you know, and has a shower and look like they haven't done anything.
Yeah.
You know, the crewing, especially for someone like, you know, obviously Melissa Urey, crewing for her in Ultraman Canada. I actually met her on the bike of day day one.
Okay.
And ended up crewing for her in Australia and Hawaii and at Uberman down in California.
And yeah, Uberman, that's another one that's like a great big event. We've had other guests on that were talking about possibly doing it. Then COVID came. That was Juan Crivari. He was lining up to do it. Tell the listeners a little bit about what that event is all about.
Oh boy. That is, well, it depends, I guess, on how you phrase it, because it's not a huge event, of course, like media wise or anything like that, or like t-shirt wise or exposure wise.
It's not bad water.
Yeah, it's not bad. No, it ain't bad water. That's for sure.
Although it's in part of the same area. Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is that it's a very low key event, and you can do it on your own. And it's a swim from Catalina Island to Long Beach, which I believe is 27 kilometers. If not, I can't remember the exact distance. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to swim it, so I didn't have to concentrate on the distance.
Yeah.
And then you get off at Long Beach, California, and then you bike up through the state, over the mountain ranges, and then the Sierra Madres, I believe, and then you end up in cycling all the way to the start of Badwater.
Right.
Over the two mountain ranges that you have to run in Badwater. You have to cycle over them. You go to Badwater, and then you do whatever you do. You turn around and you start running back and do Badwater back. Yeah. So it's basically 27 kilometers swim, then a 300 mile bike, and then it's the 135 miles for Badwater.
Right.
And it's very curious. Like, the guy that organizes it, Dan, is never returns emails. He's terrible for that. Mm-hmm. And many people can relate to race directors doing that. But
not you,
that's for sure. but one of the things is that when I was down there talking to Dan, I asked him, I said, you know, like what is the deal with this race? Like if you wanted to take 6 months to do it, you know, can you do it? Will you be recognized for it? And he goes, oh yeah, this is no time limit. And so I go like, well, that's kind of strange, but you know, like whatever, it's your race, you know, so you, and it's, he's not even really putting it on. He sort of just made this thing up and said, if somebody wants to go do it, maybe let me know and I'll be there, you know,
right.
it's that informal.
Yeah.
And I still remember, you know, sitting at that table at the awards banquet at Ultraman Hawaii with Melissa, and she looked at me and she goes, I'm thinking about doing something. And I looked back at her and I thought, oh man, she's going to do Uberman. And then she says, I want to do Uberman. And I said, absolutely. I am there. I don't care if you want me there. I'm driving down. And it says, even if you don't tell me when it is, I'm going to show up. And so I drove down and crewed for her along with a whole bunch of other people. We had two vehicles. We had a day team, a night team. Mm. We had two of my paramedic friends came. One filmed it. It's just going to put it together, hopefully a little documentary on it. And it was great fun. And I love the area. Many people that go down to that area just fall in love with that whole Badwater area, Lone Pine, and going through the mountains there. It's just spectacular. Driving, motorcycling, just being there is incredible. Yeah. You know, I had a wonderful time, especially at night. Yeah. I was down getting ready to do Ultraman Arizona. And then of course COVID happened, and I purposely drove through Winslow, Arizona, and then up through that area again, just to go back there again.
Yeah.
And go through it and to see it all again. And I drove through at night and it was spectacular, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the things, I mean, over time, Uberman, like I said, we've had breakdowns. Even my last one, we for a while we crewed for another athlete because their minivan had a flat.
Yeah.
You know, so we picked up stuff from their minivan and took it up to him ahead of time. I've seen people pull off the road and their vehicle sinks into the mud and their racer's gone and they're waiting for a tow truck, you know, on and on. It's great fun.
If I could, another one that I would like to hear about from you, because this is another person that people in the community know. And that is, you got to crew for Lucy Santino, who people probably know because she's done so many of these races and was unsuccessful so many times, but she loves to come back and keep going. Tell me about your time crewing with Lucy.
I met and got to know Lucy a little better at Ultraman Florida, and I'd heard her name before. And I like you mentioned, she just kept showing up and showing up and showing up and DNFing and not finishing for whatever reason, mostly on the run, wasn't making the run cutoff. My son got to meet her as well. And my son is fluent in Spanish. And so, you know, we even became closer friends. And she saw how I crewed people, and many of my athletes were finishing and finishing well. And she phoned me or messaged me up ahead of Ultraman Canada early last spring, and she says, "Would you crew for me?" And I said, "Absolutely, I'm there, no problem." And of course, you know, she was missing the cutoff so many times, but she had Van crewing. You know, Van was my crew partner, and we were going to crew for her. So she figured she couldn't get anybody better than Van and myself to crew for her. And if she's ever going to make it, you know, she's going to make that race. And at the same time, I'm thinking, you're picking one of the toughest races in the world to do.
Yeah.
And you want to get through it. And I said, well, I'll be there and I'll do everything I can to help you get through it. And which is, and basically the weather cooperated for her. And I was right on top of time management the whole time, you know, watching her on the bike, telling her, you know, okay, you know, if she's going to take a break, you should be able to take this much of a break and it would be fine. And the run was the same thing. You know, there were times when she would slow down to take in some nutrition and then she would stop. And I'd say, no, you're not stopping. You don't have this time to stop. You know, and just keep moving. And then it was like that the whole race. And Van was very worried that we were not going to make it. And I just kept watching the clock. And I thought, you know something, you know, as long as we can make up a little bit of time on the downhill, which I knew we could, she would make it. And she did make it.
Yeah.
And she was so happy to finish. And it was quite emotional, you know, like to see her come across that finish line and to come across with her. And to be part of her success in that, you know, it was great to be there and to be a part of it. And I'm glad I'm just really happy that that she invited me.
Yeah. And I was up there that weekend as well. And I talked to her in Van prior to the race. And I was like, oh, you got Will, no problem. You know, you got Van, you're going to get through. And I was like, you know, like what has been the problem in the past? And she's like, well, I had my family crew for me.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't want to bring that up, but I'm so proud of her for finishing.
Yeah.
And now she wants me to crew again for her in 2 years.
Oh, yeah.
Back in Hawaii. She figures that, and I figure too, that she's done so much this year that I think it's taken its toll for Hawaii.
Right.
She knows she can get this through the swim now. And she missed the first day cutoff by about 20 minutes. But I think a big part of that was she'd done Ultraman Canada and she'd done a whole bunch of other races as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that she just, you know, sat back and concentrated on Ultraman Hawaii and maybe a couple of other races in, you know, during the summer that she would probably do a lot better.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Well, that swim does get a lot of people in Hawaii.
It might not get
them right away, but by the end of the day, that swim has taken its toll on a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the 2 times I did it, I was it was okay. It went fine. The first time I did it, I had to manage the headwinds, very famous headwinds on day one there, yeah. And I ended up finishing with 12 minutes to spare. So I was very close. And the next time I was there, the headwinds never materialized, and I finished with like 1 hour and 10 minutes to spare. So it makes a difference of an hour. They're that dramatic. If you've ever been out there, sometimes it's hard to stand up. The wind is so tremendous. Mm. But this year they died down. So
right. Today's episode is brought to you by Ultra Tri Fest Canada, where you can race the traditional 515, a 515 relay, or a 515 nonstop. There's also the 360K format, which does not require a crew. And because we are hosting you in Whistler, there is also an Ultra Gravel Race. Check us out at ultratrifestcanada.com. And if you've always wanted to go to a 515 World Championship, check out the information on the website about our new Worldwide Championships, which is available to every 515 racer of all time. Again, that is at ultratrifestcanada.com, coming to Whistler, British Columbia in August 2024. And just as a heads up, we will be closing the 515 event applications at the end of March, so don't delay any longer. I was just thinking, in the races that you've done, one that pops out is the Ultraman in Israel, because not many people have done that one. And I was talking to their race director and about a year ago, and they're like, oh no, we're shutting it down. And that was before the war started, because
right.
The conflict was rising.
Yeah.
So that was one that you did. When you went for that one, did you feel safe at the time doing that race?
Yeah, I did actually. I felt no reason to be afraid.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just my personality. I don't know. Maybe after my trips to Ukraine, that's more in focus now. I've got a better handle on that. But when I was in Israel, there was a rocket attack. I got a phone call in the morning from Zayed saying that a terrorist leader had a Hamas leader had been taken out, so that they expected like 24 hours of rocket attacks.
Right.
And he said, he just gave me the lowdown on what's going to happen. And I said, okay, that's fine. And then of course the rocket attacks did happen. And then it made the news here, of course. Mm-hmm. People wanted me to come home because they thought, right. Of course I was under threat and all that stuff. Right. And I said, no, I'm going for breakfast with all the other Israelis across the street at the cafe. I mean, that's just what you did. That's just what you did there.
Yeah.
And there was the Iron Dome was in effect, of course, at that time. Yeah. And there was a rocket that did get through and hit a small part, like an intersection at the outskirts of the city. And they would classify that as a populated area. It would be like a sort of a medium sized intersection at the outskirts of like Surrey or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's a semi rural area. So I was cycling up on the Golan Heights. I made several cycling trips up there. I drove up there to check out the course. I wandered around the city of Tiberias. I went swimming in the Sea of Galilee several times, mm-hmm. which was fun. Just to even say that I did that is it's incredible. But I got caught in a thunderstorm when I was out swimming there once, and I thought, geez, That'd be the way to go at my funeral. Will Rogers, struck by lightning while swimming in the Sea of Galilee in Israel. That's such a Will Rogers thing to do, right? Yeah. And on the bike part, I didn't participate in all of the race. I just wasn't up to it for that. So I did the first day, second day I took off, and I was volunteering and helping out with some of the photography teams. And then I ran a marathon the third day. Yeah. We went down to Eilat, the city right on the Red Sea. And you can stand on the beach and look over into Egypt and then look over your other shoulder and look into Jordan. And it's that close. It's about a 10-kilometer strip, if that, mm-hmm. of Egypt right there. And so I thoroughly enjoyed my trip to Israel. Cannot wait to go back. I want to go back and maybe take a motorcycle tour with my son through Israel. He's been there before. My son works for the cruise ship industry, so they do a lot of stops there in like Haifa and Tel Aviv and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so it's one of those places I definitely want to get back to, along with many other places I've been to in the world because of racing and mostly racing.
Yeah.
And of course, Ukraine as well.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you about the Ukraine because people who know that you have traveled over there a few times now to volunteer, to help out, use your paramedic skills to help people that are injured or needing whatever aid in the Ukraine. So I do have a few questions about that, starting with how does one go to Ukraine during a war? I assume you're connected through some NGO or something like that. You don't just fly into Poland and start going into Ukraine and show up. Like what, how did it all happen for you?
It was actually fairly easy, actually. You're right. You just don't do it. But what happened was, I had heard that some paramedics out of Victoria were getting ready to purchase through donations a bunch of used ambulances out of England and then drive them across Europe to drop them off in Poland. And so I'd heard about this. I contacted them, and because of my charity work in the past, they seemed to be quite excited the fact that I was coming with them. And I said, if I can help out in any way, I will. So I actually sent them some money, quite a large sum of money to help purchase with the ambulances, and joined them on their trip over there and drove from England, through the channel in some ambulances, and then drove across Northern Europe. Mm-hmm. And we made a little bit of a detour and went to Vimy Ridge, and then ended up in Warsaw, where we dropped them off. And then one of the guys I was with, who'd been to Europe many, many times, he has relatives over there, he says, you should go to Krakow, and which is only a 2.5-hour train ride from Poland or from Warsaw. And I said, well, this, that, and the other thing, and I should get back to work and blah, blah, blah. And he says, no, if you're here, and I know you love to travel, if you don't go to Krakow, you will regret it for the rest of your life. And I went,
oh yeah,
okay, I guess I'm going. And so I went to Krakow and went to Auschwitz and Birkenau and did a salt mine tour and then came home. And I went, that was actually quite easy to get around here and get here, even though there's a major war conflict, like right next door in the country next door. And then when I got back, there's some Ukrainian nurse was collecting clothes and stuff and supplies and donations for Ukraine. And I talked to her and I said, who's your contact here in Canada? And she goes, oh, this woman, Tamara in Coquitlam. And so I got a hold of her and I said, who is your contact in Ukraine? He says, well, there's a paramedic service over in Ukraine. And I said, great, give me his number. And so she did. And I got a hold of him. I messaged him on Facebook and I talked to him on the phone. And I said, I'm a paramedic. And I told him about my credentials and my training skill level. And he says, yeah, come on over. So I made arrangements and I flew directly to Krakow from Vancouver, stayed at the same hotel again, and then made my way to the train station. And what you do is you take the Polish train to this border city, get off the Polish train, get on a Ukrainian train, and take it to Lviv. And then from there, I'd stay overnight in a hotel. And then from there, I would branch out from wherever I'm going, either Odessa or Dnipro or Kyiv. Mm-hmm. And you would take a train ride directly there. And the first time I just took the train ride directly across the country. It was a 14-hour overnight train ride, no food on the train. Mm-hmm. And a very, very old communist train. And they picked me up at the train station because nothing is flying. Of course, there's no commercial air at all.
Yeah.
And they picked me up. And from there, I went all over the southern part of the country through the active war zones. And, we transported a bunch of patients here and there. And we dropped off some equipment at hospitals. And then we went and set up mobile clinics in Kherson. I was in Kherson 4 days after the Russians left. And when I was in Kherson, if I'd climbed a 10-story building with binoculars, I could have seen the Russians on the far side of the Dnipro River.
Oh, yeah.
So we were that close. We could hear the HIMAR rockets in the distance going off and stuff like that. So it was, I wouldn't say unnerving. I wasn't nervous at any time on that trip. We slid off the road once into a minefield, but we were able to manage it. The military was there to help us out. We did some pretty good work. We made the news, made CBC. You know, I was interviewed by Gloria Makarenko as we were driving back from Kherson.
Yes, I remember hearing that on the radio. I heard that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was just a really cool experience. I mean, it's just like going to Israel, you know, you're under threat, but then, you know, when you put things into perspective, which I try and do, and sometimes, you know, foolishly, yeah. You try and downplay some of the dangers because, you know, everything has danger in it.
So what is a day like on the ground there for you? What do you do in a day, and how many hours is a shift, if you will?
Well, yeah, it's first come, first serve. I mean, we could get a phone call early in the morning and say that they needed some wounded soldiers transported from one area to another. And sometimes it's from the train station to the or from the hospital to the train station, or it's from a pickup point to a hospital in the city. Mm-hmm. And so I remember when I arrived there the second time I was there, I traveled all night from Odessa. And then the manager there says, you know, you're probably pretty tired, you know, we're going on a mission to pick up a bunch of soldiers that have been wounded, and we've got to transport them. You know, we have to drive about 100 miles to pick them up. And I said, okay, well, let's go. You know, like he was thinking I was going to rest for that day. And I said, nope, I'm here to work. So let's go. Yeah. And I ended up falling asleep in the very tight, cramped corners of a Toyota Land Cruiser that, you know, it was a wonderful little vehicle, but of course everything's no power, anything. And yeah, there was, you know, every day something went right, and every day something went wrong. And you learn to go with the flow. You really learn to think on and act on your feet and react on your feet there, depending. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the highlights or lowlights, or one of the things I was able to pull off there was, you know, they sent me, because I'd been there a couple of days and had knew my way around some of the roads by then, because we were driving a lot every day, was they sent me out to pick up a couple of soldiers. One on a stretcher and one sitting in sitting in the seat beside me from a pickup point, which I got there, and it was in a Nissan Pathfinder, standard, which, you know, obviously I being my age, I grew up on standards. And I picked him up, put him in the back of the ambulance, and put the guy beside me and drove 5 miles, and the clutch dropped right out of it. So I was synchro shifting, you know, the last 95 miles right into the city at night. Which, you know, is just one of those things, you know, like I can't just stop, right. You know, I'm not going to park on the side of the road, and there's no automobile, there's no AAA there. There's no BCAA there, you know, to come rescue my ass. You know, you do the best you can, right. You know, and you make things work as best you can for as long as you can. Even the outfit I was with, you know, I've sent them resources, sent them money and stuff like that. But everything's in short supply over there. Mm-hmm. So you just do the best you can with what you have. Yeah. And I made my way from there to Kyiv again and had a wonderful time there and met some great people, and it was good. You know, the places I stay at, the hotels now in Warsaw and Krakow and in Lviv and some of the other places, they all know me on a first name basis now, because I bring them souvenirs from Canada.
is there a couple of organizations now that you work with, if people did want to donate something, like that we can add to the show notes?
I think that I right off the top of my head, I mean, Frontline Medics is the one I was working with both times, and they're constantly in need of stuff. There's a woman from Maple Ridge running an organization almost like, almost on her own, called De Facto Humanity. And she's on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And she's doing some great work over there. There's a couple of other ones that I've touched base with over there that do rehabilitation for trauma counseling and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. and are really good. I can't remember the name right off the top of my head. It's a Ukrainian name. I don't think they have an English equivalent, so mm-hmm. I would probably butcher it anyways.
Yeah.
But that's another thing. I ran into several people over there that were humanitarians, and sometimes religious based, and sometimes just an NGO based. Mm-hmm. People there were there for either medical supplies or logistical supplies, counseling and stuff like that. It's a real mishmash of international people over there trying to, you know, do the best they can and to help out as much as they can.
Yeah. And do you think you'll be going back there again, or do you think maybe you'd want to go into Israel when it's safer? Is this the kind of thing that you're going to continue to do in your life?
Well, that's a good question, because I was supposed to be going to back to Ukraine last fall. Last fall, and that sort of fell through at the last minute. I'm having hip surgery in January 16th, and I can't fly for 3 months. So I may be flying out after that and going back there again and working with the same groups, or maybe partially with the frontline medics. Along with another group, you can see what frontline medics does. They've been on CNN, and if you punch in, you know, frontline medics and CNN, some of their stories come up. Mm-hmm. One of the guys was killed over there. The ambulance was hit by an anti-tank round, and it killed him. Mm-hmm. So that is the real danger over there. I mean, it's not made up. It's not, you know, existential. It's mm-hmm. It's literally could be around the corner there, because you just don't know.
Yeah.
And anybody that asks me about going over there or says I want to go over there, I beat that horse to death, basically, you know, telling him. I said, look, this isn't something that's, you know, meant to be a vacation adventure or whatever, or on and on and on. You know, you go over there and you work. Yeah. And they're long days, and there's some pretty horrific things you see and people you deal with, and mm-hmm. and you have to learn to to trust but verify, and then sometimes you can't trust anybody. You know, like one time one of the guys was coming around the corner, and the military was taking down a police blockade because the police were robbing everybody. Mm-hmm. And you have to be very, very aware of your surroundings as best you can. And sometimes you have to understand that things just happen, just like they happen here.
Yeah.
You know, accidents happen, things happen, and there's nothing you can do about it. Mm-hmm. The restaurant that we frequented quite a bit the last time I was there is now a pile of ashes, you know, because it was hit by a missile round.
Right.
You know, I'm assuming that a bunch of the employees, you know, the waiters and cooks and stuff like that I dealt with there, they're probably dead. You know, And so, you know, you do see that kind of damage there. Right. You know, you see roadblocks and guards on all the bridges. You see tanks and artillery in the tree lines as you're driving, you know, and trenches, defensive trenches, and mm-hmm. missiles stuck in the ground. Sometimes you have to drive around. I mean, I did all that, you know, right. So you're painfully aware of the situation you're in.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I, you know, seeing it on TV, I'm sure does not do it justice to what it's actually like when you're there.
Well, the thing is that one of the things is that when I'm there, or anybody is there, when I walk around there, I travel on the trains, you know, people see the Canadian flag on my shoulder, and they're just literally cannot believe that someone traveled across, you know, halfway around the world to be there. But, mm-hmm. you know, at the same time, it's not just me there. Like, I'm representing Canada there. And they know that Canada has sent tanks and sends money and sends resources and
right.
and things like that, and is doing quite a bit in the war effort. You know, like they're glad to have all the help they can. They wish it was more, but mm-hmm. They're ecstatic, to be provided with the tools to defend themselves and to, you know, win back parts of their country that are under threat.
Right. When you go, are you sponsored in any way, or are you paying your own dime to get over there?
It's my own dime.
Yeah,
it's my own dime. An older couple of friends of my mom and mother's up in Naramata, up in Penticton, have given me gave me a couple of $100, and they said, this is not a donation for your effort. This is for you to help cover, you know, to go to some of your costs, because it must be expensive. Mm-hmm. And it is expensive, but, you know, it's just part of it. You know, this is, I hate to say, you know, it's a terrible way to say it, but this is my not only way of giving back, but I find it incredibly gratifying, as most people, I'm sure, doing humanitarian work around the world. And I ran into other Canadians there doing that with different NGOs and organizations. And some of them, a couple of them are actually very jealous of the freedom I had over there working with a small group, because of course their organizations are very structured. They have rules of what you can do and what you can't do, where that just didn't apply to us.
Right.
You know, we could do or go wherever we want, basically because we were medical support, a standalone medical support organization. Mm-hmm. And you know, we were able to get around. One of my favorite stories is we were able to get down Kherson very easily because I bribed all the guards with pastries. You know, I would go into the coffee shop at wherever, you know, the town where in Dnipro on the way south, and or when we were staying in Mykolaiv, and I would clean out their version of the 7-Eleven of all their pastries and have a big bag of pastries and hand out pastries to the guards.
Yeah.
You know, the guys with the sniper rifles, I'd say, you know, give that guy a couple of hot rolls and stuff like that. And they thought it was just the greatest thing.
And did you learn that from doing Ultra MX?
No. Yeah. So, no, but, it was just something I thought of, you know. I thought, you know, I bet you these guys would really appreciate this. And then it sort of took off. I started doing it every day.
Yeah.
And some of the organizations, especially some of the media organizations that had to travel around in larger groups.
Right.
And of course they're all foreign nationals. They were quite jealous of the fact that we could just move around that part of the country with such ease.
Sure for them, though, it's for their own safety that there are as many rules as there are.
Yes. Yeah. They have their protocol. They have their protocols that are fine-tuned over the years and through different expectations or different experiences and stuff like that. Because, you know, it's a war. It's a war zone.
Yeah.
It's a war zone. And there's no getting around them.
Yeah. So that'll probably be in your future again. What about racing plans after you get this surgery for your right hip? Do you have any future racing plans?
The only thing I have now is I'm going to probably try and get back into my swimming, long distance swimming, cycling for sure. I quite love being just a cyclist now, but you never know. I mean, maybe when I get my hip surgery, I'll get a pedometer and put into it. measure my runs better and stuff like that. But you never know. I know five people that now that are running on their artificial hips. We will see. We will see. Never say never. I've already talked to Lucy Centenaro about that and a couple of others that, I certainly not this year, but by the time summer 2025 rolls around, I may be, you know, putting the running shoes on and seeing how things go.
Yeah.
And we'll see. I mean, I may end up doing some sprints, a half maybe, and then from there we'll maybe plan something else, but it's just one step at a time for now. Yeah. I just want to get through this surgery and get it over with and get back to, you know, work and training and stuff like that, and getting back into shape, and looking forward to another summer of cycling, doing the Grand Fondo, the Forte Fondo up Cyprus. Mm-hmm. I train quite a bit in the North Shore with all on the mountains, and then going back to Quebec for 5 days of cycling back there, which I do every September.
Right.
So,
well, you know, I can't let you go without asking you this last question. I ask all my guests that are actually from the Lower Mainland. Can you tell me what is your best time on the grouse grind?
What was it? Oh, I can't remember. I think it was 43 minutes or something like that.
Okay. Are you still able to beat your age? Do you think you'd be able to beat your age still?
Oh yeah. Oh, probably at 65. Sure. Yeah. But as that, after I get my hip done, that's one of the things I'm going to be back doing as well. Cause I'm going to be up on the North Shore quite a bit. I've got two grandkids and another, for a very good friend of mine that lives up there.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to be spending more time up there training and stuff like that. I use that as my one day base out of when I did the Triple Crown this last summer of cycling. Yeah. So, and I'll be doing that again, probably a repeat of that several times over this next summer coming up, as long as my hip will let me, and I'm very hopeful it will.
Right. Yeah. Well, Will, thank you very much for taking the time out today to come and speak to me and share your stories. I know you did a full shift today as a paramedic, and That can't be easy to come home and then start chatting again. You probably want to get some Z's. So thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. Good luck with the surgery. And if you end up going back to Ukraine, make sure you stay safe.
Thanks. Okay, Larry, thanks a lot. Thanks. Nice to hear from you. Nice talking to you. Thanks a lot.
Hey, if you liked what you heard today, please tell a friend and be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We'd appreciate it if you'd rate and review the show while you're there. Drop the names of the people you think we should interview, and we'll get in touch with them and make that happen. Thank you for listening to 515, the Ultra Podcast, a production of 5-5 Enterprises.